Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. This is our first one for 2026, so we're excited to get started again. We're very, very honored to have Dr. Nicholas Freudenberg here today. Dr. Freudenberg is a distinguished professor of public health emeritus at the CUNY School of Public Health, and he's written about corporate influences on health since 2008 and is the author of Lethal But Legal Corporations, Consumption and Protecting Public Health, which is published by Oxford University Press. And also he has written At What Cost Modern Capitalism and the Future of Health, which was a later book also by Oxford University Press. He has a forthcoming book, Fighting for New York Health and Social Justice Activism, since the 1960s. He's a member of the editorial advisory group for the World Health Organization's report on the global status of commercial determinants of health, which we're going to be focused on today, and that's due to be released in 2026. And he's also the co-author of the 2023 Lancet series on commercial determinants of health. At CUNY, Dr. Freudenberg has served as founder and director of the Hunter College Center on AIDS, Drugs, and Community Health, CUNY Cares, which is comprehensive access to essential resources and services, and the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute Health Link, which is a re-entry program for people leaving Rikers Island to return to their communities, and the CUNY School of Public Health doctoral program. So you're really welcome. I hope I did all that justice, but thank you so much for being here today. So I first heard you speak at a webinar on commercial determinants of health, and we were fascinated really to learn more about this. And we think it's something our listeners may not be familiar with. It's kind of a new term to me, relatively new term. So I think a lot of our listeners and people in the bioethics world are familiar with social determinants of health. But can you outline what are commercial determinants of health?
Yes, sure. And thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I think a very simple definition of commercial determinants of health are the ways that market actors influence patterns of health and disease in globally. And I think there has been a long interest in public health in the impact of the economy and the market system and capitalism on health, certainly since the 19th century, right? That was a lot what Marx and Engels looked at. But I think it was in the last two decades or so that folks in public health, starting with an interest in social determinants of health, developed by a group working with the World Health Organization in the first decade of this century, to understand how the broader conditions in which people live, work, play, influence patterns of health and disease. And I think the interest in social determinants of health came from a recognition that the focus on individual behavior as the primary determinant of patterns of health and disease, and the biomedical system, the healthcare system, as the primary influence on health, public health researchers came to see the limits of that more narrow approach. And so the social determinants perspective was really to look more broadly at how living conditions and allocation of wealth and power influenced health. And I think commercial determinants of health was really returning to the early interest in political economy that shaped health beginning in the 19th century, and really needing to look at how market forces influenced health. And with the transformation of the global economy in the middle and later part of the 20th century, I think this interest increased. And just one more thing to say, I think many of us think about commercial determinants of health as being one component of social determinants of health. And I think it is an important task for public health practitioners, researchers, and activists to understand the similarities and differences between social determinants of health, commercial determinants of health, and another category that people talk about, which is political determinants of health. They all interact with each other, and I think it makes more sense to understand them as a system that influences health. That was a long answer to a simple question.
No, that's very, very helpful. And thank you very much for explaining the overlap with social determinants of health and political determinants of health. When did this term arise, and why do you think it's become sort of more used now in the literature?
I think people started writing about this, including myself, in the first decade, you know, the aughts, the 2000 to 2010, and some writers refer to it. I think the earlier term, and one that I'm think as a little more meaning, is corporate influences on health. And that comes from the inference that the largest commercial entity is corporations, and particularly the, you know, 500, 1,000 multinational global corporations that really dominate the world economy. I also think the interest in commercial determinants of health begins maybe in the 1970s, when the sort of more benign, you know, sort of welfare capitalism began to shift with the neoliberal era. And I think we've seen a cascade of influences on health, the extent to which globalization is now managed by these multinational corporations, the financialization of the global economy, the deregulation and privatization, the shifting of responsibilities that in the first several decades of the 20th century had been government responsibilities, now were shifted to the market. And that shift, which some people call neoliberalism, I think attracted the interests of commercial actors, corporations, business associations, lobbyists in patterns of health and disease. And that explains the interest, particularly in the 21st century.
Thank you. So one thing we did want to focus on today was the article you have written with Dr. Kelly Lee, Annual Review of Public Health, and that was in 2022. And that article is called Public Health Roles in Addressing Commercial Determinants of Health. And you describe sort of several approaches that could be used to mitigate the negative effects of commercial determinants of health. And often we know about, you know, trying to encourage patients, for example, to stop smoking, and potentially some public health campaigns to outline some of the dangers of, you know, drinking alcohol. But there are, of course, a lot of other approaches that you outline in your article. So can you just let us share some of those with us and explain what they are?
Sure. And I think I'm a health educator by training and practice. And so I very much understand the importance of talking to individuals and communities about health behavior. It is an influence on health. But I think what we've learned over the last several decades, it is necessary but not sufficient to change individual behavior. And I think there's growing evidence that larger forces, economic forces, including the behavior of commercial actors like businesses, trade associations, financial institutions, have profound influences on health and disease. And so I think what Kelly Lee and I were saying is that we need to expand the scope of public health practice from not simply changing the behavior of individuals and families and communities, and not simply changing the policies and practices of healthcare institutions, but changing the practices of corporations and business organizations. And so we ask, how could public health take on that very ambitious task of changing how business organizations? And so we look at what has actually happened over the last 50 or 100 years, and we see many successful examples. We see, for example, the Framework Convention for Tobacco Control, where the World Health Organization brought together governments and, importantly, non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, to ask the question, how can we reduce the tremendous harm that tobacco has imposed on the health of people, killing tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people over the last several decades around the world? And I think what that investigation led to was we need to change the behavior of tobacco corporations, how they market, how they design their products, where they sell them, how much they cost. And the Framework Convention was a good example, partially successful example of coming together to say, let's change what corporations do in order to improve health. And more recently, some of the same efforts have been applied to the food industry, as we understand that the food industry and the products they produce and how they market them and distribute them and price them is now probably the largest single determinant of patterns of health and disease in the world today. Certainly in countries in the global north, but increasingly in the global south as well. And so now we ask the same question, how can we apply the lessons in controlling tobacco to the food industry? And we see in many countries, in Chile, in Mexico, in the UK, countries are starting to say, what can we do to change how the food industry produces, markets, prices, distributes products that we know make people sick, sugary beverages, highly processed food, and so on. And then just a third example where I think there's a lot to learn is around fossil fuels. Increasingly, we're seeing that the fossil fuel industry is a fundamental driver of climate change and all the harms, the health harms associated with climate change. Threats not only to the health of humans, but the health of the planet. And I think we're again seeing people coming together, the climate movement, some of the global treaties, here in the United States, the Sunrise Movement, young people mobilizing to get Congress and others to change, the disinvestment in the fossil fuel industry in order to create incentives, which were successful for many years until Trump has reversed that, in making solar and wind more profitable. And that is a huge success, an example of changing the business practices and business opportunities by looking at policy and politics. So I think we've seen in the last few decades big success stories of changing what government encourages corporations to do and regulates to get them to stop doing in order to improve health. But we still face some really deep existential challenges. And I think really the challenge of the 21st century is how the world and how we in the United States are going to reduce that cascade of corporate influences on chronic diseases, on climate change, on mental health, and on other conditions.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to mention some of those specific strategies just for the listeners. So you talk about regulating markets and non-market business practices, fiscal policy strategies, and also activism as well as litigation. So what roles can activists and social movement, you touched on this a little bit with talking about the Sunrise Movement, but what role can activists and social movements play in tackling commercial determinants of health?
I think they really play a critical role, and I will talk a little bit about why I think public health folks, both researchers and professionals, need to work more closely and align with activists. And the reason for that, I think, is because corporations have such, and business entities have such a powerful voice in our political system, many elected officials are unwilling to challenge business prerogatives and to promote regulation, and instead depend on businesses for campaign contributions and the political support they need to advance their more personal agendas rather than the well-being of the population. And so I see activists having what I call a chiropractic function, that activists can give elected officials the backbone to stand up to business interests, to look out for what they're charged with doing, which is protecting public well-being, not the well-being of special interests. And so I think we've seen that activist groups have done that around tobacco, have done that around food, have done that around climate, have done that around control of the tech sector and of social media companies in order to protect the well-being of children and young people. And so I think for those of us who are activists, we need to learn how to interact with public health professionals. For those of us who are public health professionals and researchers, we need to learn to understand the shared and differing agendas of activists and health folks and how we can align those, because we know the business interests, and increasingly in 21st century capitalism, are not focused on public well-being. They're focused on profit. And so we need to amass the political power that will be able to put out another goal and win people over to support that other goal of making improving well-being and the ability of people and the planet to prosper the priority rather than the profit of corporations.
Very interesting. And I think there's definitely a correlation between economics, finances, and of course, the interests and the powers that be. And I'm curious about your thoughts in regards to, you know, this huge field called bioethics, right? How do you think bioethics should confront the realities that you have, you know, just stressed in our conversation so far? And not just towards, you know, corporations, but functions as a particular hindrance that could harm marginalized communities. So do you think we could advocate for stronger government regulation of industry while recognizing that the state apparatus itself is a perpetrator of violence against vulnerable populations? Because I know in one hand, yes, I think it's possible, but at the end of the day, do you think that the business interests will overcome and overcome the actual instances of harm that has been done systematically, commercially, politically, within vulnerable populations or marginalized populations?
Ambitious set of questions. Thank you, Kirk. So I think the great value of bioethics within public health and health is that it emphasizes there's a moral dimension as well as a dimension of counting lives and, you know, looking at changes in statistics. My colleague, late colleague, Vic Seidel, once said that statistics, public health statistics, are human lives with the emotions washed away by tears. And I think bioethics brings back the tears, brings back the dimension. And I think public health has a very broad function that bioethics can help us return to, which is to say that there are moral values that we stand for, and we have the obligation not only to stand up for science, that's also a very important issue, but to stand up for moral values. And so to give an example, I've done work around food marketing to children and against what a group that I've been working with calls predatory marketing, marketing products known to harm health as a way of increasing profits. And I think that bioethics can introduce the topic that it should not be acceptable. It should not be morally acceptable and eventually politically acceptable to market a product known to damage health, to cause preventable illness and premature death, particularly to children and other vulnerable populations. And so therefore, the law should move to make immoral things illegal, that a company should not be able to profit. Coca-Cola should not be able to get rich by selling children products that will rot their teeth, give them diabetes, make them obese, put them at risk of premature death. And that's a discussion, a moral discussion, a philosophical discussion that I think bioethics can play an important role. I think one of the limitations of bioethics as practiced in the United States in the last few decades is it's focused very heavily on individual behavior and on the freedom of individuals to make choices. And I think individual freedom is important, but collective responsibility is also important. And there have been two American traditions, and I think they're both as American as cherry pie, you know, and one says individuals should have the freedom to do whatever they want, you know, sometimes with the exception that it doesn't directly hurt someone else. But the other is we look out for each other. You know, we take care of each other. That's an American tradition too. And bioethics could help us find the right balance between those two traditions as it applies to coming up with policies and regulations and practices that promote health. Again, a long answer to a question, but those are some of my thoughts.
Oh, well, I had a very long question, so it's fair. thank you. I'm also interested, I have tons of questions. I have two more before I bring it back over to my colleague, Amelia. And this is a question I didn't originally send you, but I know this is tied to the commercialization of health. And it's, of course, artificial intelligence, specifically these data centers that are popping up literally all over, which has, at least in early studies, because this is, you know, ongoing and recent, it's definitely having environmental impacts negatively on, you know, water and water consumption. Early studies on individuals living near these data centers that create poor health outcomes as well. So in a way, it's just another reification or another reinvention of another thing that helps those who are in power, right? Helps the corporations, those who are making billions upon billions of dollars off of it. But at the end of the day, it's at the consequences and at the expense of, you know, communities, usually communities that are vulnerable and really, you know, individually don't have a voice. Collectively, yes, but are often being ignored. So I'm just curious on the rise of AI and all of the consequences. Good, yes, some good, but also we can't ignore the bad consequences systemically of artificial intelligence. How does this commercialization, you think, impacts these communities, but also any type of solutions you think that we could try to implement now while this is still going, while all these AI centers are being built, that we could have some type of regulation or protection? I know another very long question, but I know that you're more than capable of, you know, trying to answer, you know, the complexities of what's going on right now with artificial intelligence.
Right. And another really important question. And I think I will talk about the tech industry, which controls artificial intelligence, but it also controls social media, and it controls the sort of surveillance, the growth of the surveillance state, both in government and in corporations. And I think what those practices of the tech industry raise is, in my mind, new technology is neither good nor bad. And I think artificial intelligence has the potential to bring real benefits to the population as a whole. But the question is, who's going to control that industry? And who makes decisions about how it gets deployed and where it goes? And I think the questions you raise point to the fact that it's current control by a handful of billionaires who are very weird people. If we look at the practices of the billionaires in the United States who control the tech industry, very weird in what their priorities are, you know, looking to settle people in space, looking to have, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of children to, to promote their own genetic material. So they're very weird people. And the thought that those people should be deciding the future of our country simply because they've managed to accrue billions of dollars is very scary. So I think the question really comes down to democracy, you know, and what in a democracy, how do we ensure that the people and that our political system, as it was intended to be, with people having a voice in it, makes the decisions about how technology is deployed. And unfortunately, I think what we've seen in the last couple decades, the United States is moving in the wrong direction, where government is abdicating responsibility for controlling technology, like the AI centers, like the recent decision by the Trump administration to not even look at air pollution's health effects, you know, something that they're required by the legislation to look at. And now the Trump administration says, we don't want to look at the health effects of air pollution in order to decide what to regulate and how to regulate it. So I think both public health folks and activists need to work together to make sure that people understand the question isn't AI yes or no. The question is, how are we going to use it and who's going to make those decisions? And if it continues to be that those decisions are made in order to maximize profits, we're going to see some very harmful effects. And if we figure out ways to democratize it, and I think that includes looking at our regulations around monopoly and reducing monopoly control, and that is a big debate in this country. And I think there are political factions and political groupings who have made controlling monopoly a priority, and a lot of people support that. We need to help people understand the value of monopoly control. I think also that who benefits from regulation and who's harmed by it, that's also something that public health folks need to begin to talk about. Good regulation protects rich people and poor people. Controlling environmental pollution benefits everybody. And in the short term, some billionaires might profit from less environmental regulation. But in the long run, their children and grandchildren are going to suffer by it. And we need to make that clear. And I think similarly around climate change, that all of us will be affected by climate change. Maybe a few people plan to go live on Mars when the climate on Earth no longer becomes fit for human. But that isn't a realistic solution. And so in public health, we need to be promoting realistic solutions and mobilizing the political power to advance those solutions. And that means using all the, you know, all the potentials of government around regulation, education, taxation is another really important. All people benefit from good use of taxation. There's been a lot of debate in New York City. We have a new mayor, and some people are worried about putting taxes on the rich. We'll leave rich people to leave. But no, the evidence doesn't point in that direction. Rich people want an environment that makes it easy for them to move around the city, that makes it safe for them, that makes it easy to get the health care they need. And when people leave the city, it's because they can't afford housing or food or education or childcare. And so making things more affordable, which is another function of government, will benefit all people, not just the poor.
Absolutely. Thank you. And it's so interesting how history continues to repeat itself. Now they say we're in the Gilded Age, 2.0, which even surpasses those of, the Carnegies and Rockefellers and Pierpoints and, all these other famous names, back in the late 19th century and early 20th century as well. And I also would like to talk about something that you usually don't think about when it comes to the commercial determinants of health, at least I don't, and that's campaign finance. Because part of the monopolies that we currently have is intricately connected to, Citizens United. And again, Citizens United, for our particular listeners, was a landmark case in 2010 by the Supreme Court that basically established corporations and unions to have First Amendment rights of free speech, and actually saying that money, the actual usage of money, is free speech in itself. And of course, that opened Pandora's box to all this dark money in politics, these super PACs, and many other different forms of funding the special interests, meaning, you know, corporations in campaigns, and as well as many other facets with, you know, elected representatives that supposed to represent the people, but especially in recent times, as you see, on paper they represent people, but they ultimately want to represent the special interests, you know, the folks that fund their campaigns. It is a sad reality, but it is a real reality that money does talk and influence how our elected officials govern, right? And how they say yes or no to different policies and practices. So I'm interested on your thoughts regarding, of course, this is the reality. How do you think we as a people, right, this advocacy mentality and using our voices, how can we at least start chipping away and alleviating these particular structures like Citizens United and other forms of funding that doesn't necessarily represent the interests of the whole, but as we've talked about before, a handful of individuals?
Well, I think with the national political scene in the United States, for at least in the current period, dominated by a very the right-wing control of the Supreme Court and Congress and the White House, I think there's a lot of opportunity for making progress at the local and state level. And I think in campaign finance, as well as in other areas, the task for the next few years is to try out different things, see what works, and then think about what would it take to extend that to other states. And then nationally, when we have a government that is more interested in protecting people than profit. And I think New York City is a good example around campaign finance, where we do have public funding for city races. And I think the consensus among political scientists is in New York, it's made races a little more open. And we saw in the mayoral race, the candidates with the most money are not necessarily the ones that did the best and the ones who got money from the wealthiest people. And I think coming up with ways of testing out ways of publicly supporting campaigns, building popular support for that at the local and state level so that we can, in time, move that to the national level. I also think that there are now a number of groups who are coming up with new ways of communicating with the public, and the mass demonstrations, the use of social media, the integrating demonstrations and social media, those are ways to counteract the influence of money in politics. And so I think that's another promising direction. And those of us in public health ought to be looking for ways to advance our own health campaigns using those various technologies to promote the work we do, with the understanding that in the long run, we want a government that supports public health, not one that undermines it.
I love the way you brought in all those points from so many different areas, and they all sort of fall into this category of commercial determinants of health. And thank you as well for bringing up the moral implications of all of this. So I wanted to just ask about a couple of other things that fall under this. Firearms is one. You know, it's poorly regulated, but this really is a commercial determinant of health. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, and I think people are thinking both about firearms and weapons, you know, military. And I think it's important to understand both of those domains as being adverse influences on national health, but also on global health. For example, the military has played a very strong role in, you know, in just the campaign contributions we were talking about supporting candidates and supporting a national agenda that includes wars in many parts of the world, because that's how they profit, you know. And so what would it, you know, what would a group that was looking for maintaining the strength of the United States and its standing in the world, but not having, you know, not spending so much on weapons and the military and bombing people. I think more at the weapons level, we see the role that the firearms industry has played in resisting efforts to regulate more fully. And I think we've seen a diminishment of the influence of the NRA in the last few years as they fell into some of their scandals and corruption and illegal practices. And so I think keeping scrutiny, it points to the importance of investigative journalism and a free media to look at what when industries are either breaking the law or acting unethically, to educate the public about that. But I also think it's a standing problem how much influence the gun industry has had on gun policy, and points to the longer run issue of developing lobbies. For example, until I believe it was 2018, Congress prohibited federally funded research on gun violence. So here you have a major cause of morbidity and mortality, and public health researchers couldn't research because the gun industry persuaded Congress to pass financing rules that didn't allow the Centers for Disease Control to fund that research. Some of that has begun again. But that is an example of the really outrageous and ludicrous rules that are passed by industries to promote their self-interest. And I think we need to look at ways to counteract that. With the gun industry as well, we've seen, you know, vigorous use of local and state regulation to push the envelope a little bit. And some of that gets overturned by the Supreme Court, which is also very gun-friendly. And that also speaks to the long-term importance of looking at, you know, what we want the Supreme Court to look like over the next several decades. And if it continues on its current path of seeing its primary allegiance being to business interests and commercial interests, we'll have a very hard time protecting public health in the United States over the next several decades.
Yeah, 100% agree. I also wanted to touch on vaping because, you know, you mentioned the tobacco industry earlier on and sort of smoking's denormalized. That's one of the words that you bring up in your article. Can you talk a bit about vaping and sort of how the industry promoted vaping and what sort of strategies public health can use to try and reduce vaping? And I did read this morning that Belgium has banned the selling of e-cigarettes, I believe. So it's different. When I was in Europe and I thought there was more vaping there, but I believe it really depends on the country. But vaping and the use of e-cigarettes is increasing over the last few years. I believe it's about 6-7% among young adults.
I think it illustrates some of the points that we've discussed, that the technology of nicotine substitutes and other forms of people using isn't in itself either beneficial or evil. And I think most public health folks agree there might be a place for nicotine substitutes in helping people who are already addicted to tobacco smoking to quit smoking. But the question is, who controls that technology and to what ends? And what we saw with the vaping industry was, again, this example of predatory marketing, very aggressive marketing, flavoring it with all sorts of things and targeting their marketing. Juul is a good example of that, who's been taken to court and had to change some of their practices specifically to appeal to young people. And that is where government has not fulfilled its responsibility. It's really most basic responsibility, which is to protect public health. To my mind, the responsibility to protect public health and the well-being of the population supersedes the responsibility to protect profits of a particular segment of industry. And I think the allowing the vaping industry to target first children and now children and young people for marketing showed the rapid spread of vaping among young people. And I think it's again a question of, you know, where I think the ethical dimensions of that come in. And do we want to be a society where a variety of actors, whether it's the sugary beverage industry or the vaping industry or the tobacco industry or the, you know, the influencers promoting one product or another, do we want to allow them unfettered access to our children to promote products that will make someone rich? Or do we want to say we're a society that cares about our children and protects them and sets up, you know, reasonable limits on marketing to children and young people? The specifics of that, the details, of course, are complex. But I think other countries in all these dimensions around, you know, vaping, around food, around tobacco, around alcohol, everywhere, there are some solutions that have been tried and shown to be successful. And I see as part of my job as a public health researcher is to spotlight those successful examples, to create, you know, what some people call practice-based evidence, as well as research-based evidence, to inform discussion, to inform activism, to inform political debates, so that we have a wider array of evidence than simply the randomized trials, which will always limit what we know about what we can do. And if scientists and public health folks are limited to randomized trials and the businesses can do whatever they want with no evidence, we're going to risk endangering the health of people.
So I've just one other question before I hand it back to Kirk. So in the US, what do you see as the policy and research priorities for the work on commercial determinants of health? What areas do you think should be the focus?
Right. I can say a few things. I think there are a few industries that we know play an outsized role: food, tobacco, alcohol, social media, fossil fuels, and certainly, you know, what some people call the health harming industries. We ought to focus our efforts on those, and particularly on the health outcomes, chronic diseases, a lot of interest in air pollution as a growing cause of premature death and preventable illness. So we ought to focus on the most harmful ones. And second, I think the evidence that I've gotten on looking at, you know, what we've learned from other parts of the world is I think we're not looking for one-shot solutions, but for policy packages. And I think to look for those things that will influence multiple harmful industries. So I think monopoly control, truthful marketing, disclosure of what a company knows about the harmful consequences, forcing industries, as was done with the tobacco industry, to pay the costs, not being able to externalize them to taxpayers or consumers. We ought to be looking for ways of institutionalizing those practices across industries. And again, because of the current control of the federal government by profit-endorsing political factions, we'll need to try some of that at the local and state level first and look to other countries and look to international organizations. But we also, if we look at the last century, there's a lot of experience. We were among the leaders in developing environmental regulations and implementing and enforcing them. We need to resume that leadership. We were, you know, setting the standard for enhancing solar and wind power. You know, that's now been at least temporarily reversed by the current administration. We need to be going back to looking to have as our goal setting global leadership. We created many of these health and environmental problems, so we have an ethical and moral obligation to come up with a solution. It's also my generation and your generation as well, I think, have a particular responsibility to solve some of the problems that we're imposing on our children and grandchildren. So it's on us, you know, and I think some of the work that Bill McKibben is doing around the third force, around organizing older people to take responsibility for fixing the world that we're leaving in such bad shape to younger people, is another powerful moral argument for making progress in this period. I hope that answered your question a bit.
Thank you very much. So I have two questions. The first is, of course, we discussed a lot of issues and complexities that we are dealing with currently in our society. I'm sure you heard about universal basic income. And for our listeners who do not know what UBI or universal basic income is, it's basically unconditional cash payments to all citizens regarding of their income or work status. And not to rehash, but this is also connected about to the fear about AI taking over a lot of jobs, and then of course the fear of individuals, you know, a mass amount of people not be able to work, and how they're going to provide for their, you know, themselves, their families, etc. So my question is, do you think we will have universal basic income? And do you think that it will help alleviate some of the determinant, some of the issues that we have in society today?
I'll use your question, I hope to answer it, but also to make a broader point. I think universal income, the limited evidence that's available shows that it can have real, you know, major health benefits. So I think it's worth pursuing. But I think we who are both public health professionals and activists have to continually balance incremental changes with transformative changes and develop a strategy for having incremental changes lead us to transformative changes. And I think sometimes folks in our space have gotten tied into one or the other. Either it's universal basic income or you focus on some very small changes. I think some of the things that I think will that are more modest changes that will take us on the path to incremental changes are universal childcare, that everyone should have free access to childcare. And that, you know, will take some resources, but that is something we could realize in the next several years, you know, certainly here in New York City and in other states, as other countries have shown. I think free public transport is another example of something that will make it easier for people to get around. It will benefit people who are most vulnerable and most disenfranchised, but it will also benefit society as a whole, because a more mobile society gives us all opportunities. Making higher education free, and maybe starting with community college, I think is another example. So I think, significantly expanding SNAP, food stamps, to make sure that all sectors of the population experiencing food insecurity have some access to food benefits, that food security becomes a human right rather than a privilege that is determined by the market. So I think we need to be exploring both those things, the more, in some ways, radical idea of universal basic income and the more incremental way of looking at the necessities of life and making them rights rather than privileges. We should be pursuing both those paths. And if we polarize it to say we need to do one or the other, we divide people instead of bringing them together. And if we're going to win, we need to be united to stand up to the people who want to make profit the sole criterion for deciding what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not either or, it's kind of like both and, right? A more holistic approach to try to solve all of these complex problems that we discussed. My last question is, why commercial determinants of health? I'm interested on your why in being in this particular specialty or niche within public health. And what type of work do we have to look forward to, kind of like a sneak peek? What are you working on, and what not just our crew at Bioethics in the Margins, but of course our audience could look forward to in current research and other works that you are currently working on right now?
Sure. Great question. So I think my view is, in the last few decades, we have seen a cascade of threats to health. You know, certainly the COVID pandemic, the continuing burden from chronic diseases, the growing burden of mental health, the climate emergency, the rise, you know, the growth of air pollution that we've seen that is particularly having an effect in Global South. So I think it's never been clearer that business as usual is not working to protect the well-being of people and the planet. And so I think we need something new. And if I look at that cascade of public health emergencies, I see underlying each is a set of commercial actors that are not the only cause, but it cuts across all of them. And so I think if we're going to create a healthier planet for the middle part of the 21st century, we need a different level of success in taking on commercial determinants of health. And I think the work that the World Health Organization has started to do to put that on the agenda of the public health community, to put it on the agenda of ministries of public health in low, middle, and high income countries, that's really important. And we ought to be continuing that. And I may or may not agree with some of the specific recommendations of the World Health Organization, but I think they're very well situated to promote a global discussion and to bring public health folks from around the world into thinking about what can we do and what's the evidence we'll need to see what works and what doesn't work. At the more local level, I've done a lot of work in the last decade or so on food, and there's pretty compelling evidence that in New York City and in the United States, unhealthy food is the primary driver of chronic diseases, in specific heart disease, certain forms of cancer, diabetes, but also, you know, probably the largest single cause of premature deaths and preventable illnesses. And so I'm thinking about what's an agenda for creating healthier food environments in New York City over the next decade. And I think one piece of that is to look at what is the food industry doing, marketing sugary beverages, deciding where to open supermarkets, deciding what price to charge, and where are the openings for government action, particularly in this phase at the city and state level, for reducing predatory marketing, for pricing healthy food more accessibly and unhealthy food maybe a little less so, for ensuring that our public food, school food, hospital food, jail food is healthy and supports health. So I think that is something I expect to be working on. And what are the commercial drivers of ill health in relation to food in a place like New York City? And what can public health researchers, nutritionists, our students, you know, community organizations, government agencies do to move that in the right direction? And I think there's similar opportunities around healthcare, around pollution, around sexual and reproductive health, around environmental justice. So I'm hoping, you know, the people I've been teaching, my colleagues can take on some of those challenges, and that what we leave New York in the next decade is a city that more fully realizes its potential to be the healthiest city in the world and the country to be the healthiest country in the world, instead of pretty far down because we're not achieving that potential.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Nick, as a fellow neighbor here in New Jersey, I could talk to you all day, because this is what one of the things that I'm personally passionate about and definitely speaking my language. And just thank you so much for a very enriching conversation. And yeah, we have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to try to make where we live, the society we live, a more holistic place. And it's not just one thing, as we discussed. There's many different ways we could approach this in trying to make things more equitable for everyone. So thank you so much for your interdisciplinary skills. We went from technology to government to politics, and you answered very eloquently and definitely left a lot of gems for our audience. So we definitely appreciate your time today.
I think I can maybe end with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., because it was his day yesterday. And just a few days before he was assassinated in Memphis, someone asked him, you know, would you have preferred to live in another time? And he said, no, this is exactly the time I'm happy to live in, because I have so many opportunities to make the world better. And he said, I understand why some people might be surprised at that, but never have the opportunities been greater for improving the world. And that really moved me reading that, and made me think that we have to communicate that optimism and that opportunity to the people we work with. And I hope our discussion today helped do that for some folks.
Yeah, many thanks. Yeah, I'm glad you're doing this amazing work. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chun. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.